and the moon is the only light I see. No, I won't.
Who's up for talking nonsense?
Who's up for talking nonsense?
This is the American Jezebel.
And the Greasy Rapidian.
And welcome to Talking Nonsense.
Talking Nonsense, episode number 8.
Wow, we're so close to our double digits.
That's impressive.
Oh,
no. A lot of people thought we wouldn't last more than 3 or 4. So all you doubting Debbies.
Yeah, take that, Debbies.
In your face.
Oh, we love you, Debbies.
We
do. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for continuing to listen to this nonsense.
Thanks, Debbies.
We've gotten some feedback that is... told us that was a lot of nonsense.
Yeah, but we are living up to our billing.
That's literally the title of the show.
Literally. So if you came for some insightful, penetrating views into father-daughter relationships as accessed through coming-of-age movies and liminal space movies, you're kind of in the right place.
There's a little bit of that. That's true. Oh, look, there's that first just cackling away already over here.
That's what we're about. Some serious cackling. Oh, we should welcome back one of our former future...
our continuing future sponsors.
Well, there was a former future sponsor, but they're back as a future sponsor.
They are.
Tony's Chocololi.
Ah, Tony's.
Tony, we have a new... Tony's Chocololi. This episode is sponsored by Tony's... coconut pecan chocolate. Yeah, no, it wasn't. I'm sorry, Tony.
We're never gonna get sponsored by Tony's if you say it wasn't delicious. The flavor that was that we designated for this episode.
Okay, well, if you like coconut and pecan and you like eating your chocolate and feeling like you ate a little bit of the wrapper,
Tony is never going to call us back.
Call us.
He's never going to call us back now.
Tony, I will so eat a case of your caramel sea salt.
And the other reason that we love Tony's is because
slave-free
Tony's
chocolate.
Is about slave-free chocolate.
Slave-free chocolate.
Yes.
So I will suffer through a coconut pecan chocolate bar. Just because it was done correctly.
Yes.
Sometimes it's like that. I went to the local kombuchery here in town, and I won't name them because I'm hoping that they will sponsor us.
That would be exciting.
That would be super exciting. But there were some flavors there that were like black.
Did you try? Did you do like
five,
a flight?
5 different flavors.
What was the best flavor?
The best flavor was ginger.
Mm.
You got to go with the old standby. There's a reason why it's there, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a reason why... those things are still around.
Well, on my part,
but the
Tony's,
coconut chocolate.
Call us. Call us, Tony's. Don't listen to him.
And I did not have the Enjoy check because I wanted to try other people's.
Uh-huh.
And I am sad now that I did not stick with one of our former future sponsors, Enjoycha Kombucha. Because that probably would have been good rather than going for the other unnamed ones that were not good.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying not to make the same mistake that we've made with Jim Carrey.
Speaking of,
oh my God,
Greasy Rapidian, do we have any degree to disagree this week?
Yeah, so we need some theme music. You doing it or am I?
Nobody, we're putting it in.
Okay, so this is where the music comes in. Shh, shh. We had another agree to disagree. Pray when Debbie called us. she wrote to us, and she was. Again, Jim Carrey, not likable. And so we've gotten more response to the Jim Carrey comment than we have to almost anything we've done.
Anything else?
Yeah.
On par with The Kissing Booth, which is actually a controversial film.
Yes. And so those of you out there that love Jim Carrey, all I have to say from the bottom of my heart, we're going to have to agree to disagree.
Oh, man. Who knew that the Jim Carrey fans...
Who
what
knew?
What are they called? Carriers?
Carry on?
All those
carry-ons.
Oh,
no. Now I got them going again.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
We're going to get so many emails now.
Listen, Bruce Almighty 420. Just chill, man. Just chill.
I'm going to say
wake
Bruce...
and bake, brother. Just
yes. Bruce Almighty has not written in. They've just given us a follow because... because Bruce Almighty, living up to his name, is very chill.
Yeah. So, yeah. Anyway, so we agree to disagree.
Agree to disagree.
Take the music out.
Well, speaking of new of music, we probably need some new theme music because we have a new segment this week.
A new segment.
A new segment.
What is our new segment?
Our new segment is, in this case, Jezebel says, "What is this movie about?"
Jezebel says,
"What?"
Oh, that's a little shout out because we are ruffians.
We are real ruffians.
Oh my god,
ruffians for life!
Yeah, we love you. Call,
call. Oh, she called us,
Amber Ruffian. Call us.
Oh. God. So our new segment, Jezebel says, "What is this movie about?" Is because this is the first of the movies that we've done, any of our liminal space movies that I had never seen before. I watched it before this for the podcast.
Okay,
so I have gone many, many years without ever seeing Stand By Me,
but I've heard and. Heard tell of.
Like Nick Offerman in The Kings of Summer, I was a child on planet Earth, and so I have heard things about Stand By Me. Yes.
All right. Well.
So before I went and watched the movie today, I recorded a little spot where I made some predictions based on pop culture and growing up in America, what I thought that Stand By Me was about.
Okay, and so this may be the hardest part of this podcast, harder than getting two microphones, which we don't have yet. So all of you tech people,
get two microphones in.
Yeah, somebody just write to us and tell us how we can get Audacity with two microphones. And so anyway, that was hard, but not as hard as it's going to be for me to be quiet while the Jezebel lays out her. So here's the part where I'm going to be quiet.
So we're so excited to have this new segment here on the podcast, where if one of us has not seen the movie, we're going to guess what we think that the movie is about, based on all of the pop culture and general knowledge about these things that has filtered through. So this week's movie that I have never seen before in my life is Stand By Me. Okay, things that I do know is that it is, or things that I think I know to be true, is that it's based on a Stephen King story. And I think that it involves, based on the iconic scene from Stranger Things, a bunch of kids walking down some railroad tracks. I think that happens in the movie. And I also think that they find a dead body. I think that this is the movie where some kids find a dead body. And then lastly, I know for sure that the bully in the movie is Kiefer Sutherland. I guessed Ethan Hawke and Josh Brolin, and it took me a minute to come back around to, no, it was actually Kiefer Sutherland. My other guesses about this movie, I'm thinking there are like no adults in this movie. This is my guess going in. It's going to be extremely kid-focused, kid-perspective movie. I think that there's going to be a few girls in this movie, too. I think it's going to be a very young boy perspective of the world, figuring out what to do if they find a dead body, which is a very adult thing. That is my guesses about this movie.
All right, so that those were my predictions pre-watching this movie, and I have now watched this movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what about the blurb on, we watched it on, we paid for this one.
We did. This was not a Netflix free streaming.
Netflix, sponsor us too. Come on.
Come on, Netflix.
I will actually say that I like you. Tony, I love you. I love you, Tony. I just didn't like that flavor.
Okay. So are you ready for the official description of Stand By Me? All right. Here is the description. Culled from the internet.
Okay.
Four young friends find the remains of a missing teenager in this first-rate adaptation of Stephen King's The Body.
Okay.
That is the description for this movie. How accurate do you feel this description is? My favorite is that it has a quality judgment inside of the description.
Say this again.
They call it a first-rate adaptation.
Oh.
Yes.
Yeah, that's going to take a little beating in this podcast.
Okay. I have not read The Body, so I don't know how well they adapted this story.
Okay, well,
Have you read the novella?
I'm trying to think if I have or not. That's a good question. I can't remember if I have, because I'm thinking I have.
Okay. How good of a description do you think this is?
I think that is a description of something that happens in the movie.
Yeah, but is it a description of the movie itself?
Yeah, so that would probably not entice me to watch this movie.
No.
So four young friends find a body. Oh, I've been looking for a find a body movie, right?
Yes.
Not kind of.
Probably what. Also a reason that this movie is called Stand By Me and not called The Body.
Correct.
Because would you want your children watching a movie called The Body?
And The Body isn't, the Standing By is more, Standing By Me is more important than The Body.
It is much more descriptive of what happens in this movie.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's kind of lacking.
Right.
Which not is, terribly, I mean, it is incorrect because it's actually not a teenager that they find. It's somebody their age.
No,
because the voiceover says that they're still looking for 12-year-old Ray Brower or whatever.
Oh, I thought he was 13.
So he's their age. No, he's not a teen. They said 12-year-old.
Oh, I thought that was the radio.
Yeah, the radio guy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Because for some reason, I thought he was 13.
No.
So.
He looked old.
He did look old.
It looked like that was an adult man's body.
Yeah, the train will take it out of here.
It really will. Spoiler it will alert. Age you up a lot.
Well, it knocked him out of his kids, right?
It did.
So it aged him about 40 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. That was a 30-year-old in kids. Yeah. Okay, so how would you describe this movie? This was a bit of a lacking description then.
Right, and so this really is, because we're watching it, it's a coming-of-age liminal space movie.
It
so
is.
These are about young boys who are prepubescent, who are on the cusp, because they're going into junior high. It's a big transition for them.
It is.
And they're having to decide if they're going to go to shop classes or college classes.
They're 12 years old! Why are they going to college classes? I'm already getting so loud because I'm so mad about this. How is this possible? These are children!
And so evidently, I went back and watched the little x-ray factoids on the side of it, so I went back and just scrolled through to see, because I was like, where is this supposedly taking place?
And
so
where?
Yeah, supposedly.
Well, he tells us.
Where?
Where the movie takes place?
Yeah.
It's in Oregon.
Yeah, it's in Oregon, but in the body, it's in Maine.
It's in Maine, because all Stephen King stuff is in Maine.
And,
they all have French-Canadian names, too.
So, yeah.
There's Duchamp and Lachance.
Yeah, Lachance.
And, yeah, they're all French-Canadian, I would assume. Or Acadians, probably.
Yeah. And so I was like, okay, does the school system in Maine or Oregon have a distance system than what I grew up with? This was 57.
This was before your days.
A little before my days.
Yeah.
Not a whole lot, you know, but a little, you know. And I was like, was there a major shift after the 60s to get rid of shop and college classes?
When you're 13?
As tracking in America? I was like, I'm not really clear on that part of the story. But anyway.
It is a coming of age story. Yes.
Yeah.
They're facing this moment when they're all going to go their separate ways.
Or not.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And, you know, they're dealing with their relationship with their parents.
Mm-hmm.
And then they decide to go on this adventure.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so much like the Kings of Summer from last week.
There were some real parallels.
Yeah, that's going to come up in one of my themes of it. And so they go on this adventure that they take together, the four of them, a little buddy movie.
Mm-hmm.
So the four of them go on this adventure, and then all these things come out during the adventure to reveal different characters and the struggles they have. And then they stand by each other in certain ways. And then they come to the climactic ending where, you know, they have to really stand by each other and take a stand for who they are in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then the movie kind of wraps up with them going their separate ways. You see them kind of branching off, just like we saw in, you know, last week's Kings of Summer, when the cars go different directions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one kid goes one way, one kid goes another way, two kids stay together for a while, and then goes a different way.
Mm-hmm.
And so you literally, again, see them choosing their paths in life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the wrap-up of the movie. We're not going to spend lots of time going into blow-by-blow scenes until we start to unravel what we think this movie is about.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was really interesting, too. I know we need to get into just like a real discussion of the movie for a little bit. And this was also our first period film.
Yeah.
Yes. And I'm sure that we'll have a few more, like American Graffiti, which will come up later.
Oh, even Breaking Away.
Breaking Away is a period movie as well? Okay.
Well.
You know, because this is made in the 80s looking back on the 50s.
No.
Right?
Breaking Away will not be.
Was it contemporary when it was made? So
it's
now an older movie, but it's not a period piece, where this one is.
Yeah.
Is this kind of semi-nostalgic look back at a certain period of time. And I think it's especially interesting that this, again, is our boy movies trilogy, right?
Yeah.
And this is also taking place in the late 50s, which is kind of the heyday of super traditional masculinity and a certain vision of what masculinity should be. Right. And that these boys are in many ways dealing with, especially Gordy, of what he should be and what his father thinks he should be and what he is.
Yes.
Yes. And I guess all of them are a little bit more, you know.
Yeah.
That, you know, Chris is dealing with the same thing of, does he go into the mold of what kind of man his brother and his father are, as is Teddy. And less so Vern. We don't really learn very much about Vern's family.
We don't learn much about Vern's.
Is that Blonde Kid his brother? Who was on the porch that then is like, I'm gonna give you a hiding or whatever. It's just like taking off his belt when he walks down there. What is, you know, that blonde kid?
I know. There was the two of them on the porch, but I thought they were brothers.
But are they Vern's brothers? Are they just at Vern's house?
I think one of them is Vern's brother, okay. And I'm not sure which one, because the blonde kid actually even then says, oh, Vern, you told, you son of a whore. And I was like,
well, that's a terrible thing to say about your own mother.
I know. And so that's why I was like, it can't be his brother.
Maybe it's the brother's friend, the other kid's his brother.
Yeah.
Yeah. They do love insulting mothers, though.
And but the mothers are also in great reverence. You swear on your mother's good name.
That's true. Yeah.
Well, evidently you don't value your mother's good name very much.
This movie does not pass the Bechdel test, for sure.
It's pretty hard to come up with more than one woman.
I think it's only his mom, and she doesn't say anything. Oh, she says just like two lines. The waitress and the mom, and they never interact.
They
never interact.
They even gave the waitress a name. Would they say plastic hair or something? They give her.
Yeah, yeah. But I think the mom only has like two lines at the dinner table scene.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, so and the waitress has one line.
Yeah.
Who's setting off cherry bombs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it.
That's it.
Well, because they haven't discovered girls yet, as they say, when they're having their conversation around the fire.
Really?
They're having a really interesting, things that are really interesting until you discover girls.
Well, they were talking about Annette Funicelli and before that.
Yes.
So I'm not sure the movie actually holds up.
Not so sure about those things. All right.
Okay.
But I just thought it was very interesting that, you know, like the movies that we're watching over the course of this trilogy, this is in many ways a movie about masculinity and boyhood and manhood. And I think it's very interesting that it takes place in this period of time that was itself, you know, culturally very concerned with what does it mean to be a man. You want to talk a little bit about what you wanted to bring up, what you think is one of the themes of the movie?
Right. And it'll follow up on what you're saying there, because one of the kind of crucial elements to the Kings of Summer, and we'll see it play out again in Breaking Away. Mm-hmm. And so I won't spoil it for you.
Don't say anything. I got to make my predictions.
I won't spoil it, but the young men and the young boys' relationship to manhood as it expresses in nature. Right? And so it will show up in all three of these movies. And you wouldn't think, especially in Breaking Away, that it would show up, but it does. It shows up very strongly. I had seen the movie many times, probably three or four times, but I haven't seen it for maybe 20 years.
Okay.
And so I have a little nostalgia of the movie. You know, because I like Rob Reiner as a director and I like him as a human being. And so I just have like a warm spot because he created these kind of iconic movies. He just had a good run, right? Of creating a series of iconic movies. At the same time that he personally was struggling just to be a person. And he was openly saying, you know, every day I wake up and I'm afraid. Which is incredible, as he was just creating one thing after another, right? And so I just have great admiration, and so I had this warm spot for him. And then watching the movie, I was like, oh, it's almost unwatchable.
Really?
Yes.
You found this movie to be almost unwatchable?
Yes.
Okay, why was that?
Stephen King just irritates the crap out of me.
The emails that we're going to get now. Going after Jim Carrey, going after Stephen King.
I am
going
to go after Stephen King because this movie, it just was, it was just so heavy-handed in so many ways. The bullies were so bad. in the end when he stands up to him. It's a real, you know. Mm-hmm. And so much of it was so heavy-handed in the foreshadowing. There's the gun, it goes off accidentally, and then the gun, he shoots the gun in the end, you go...
I think in my notes I wrote, here is a literal Chekhov's gun, like, yeah. Here it is, we know it's coming back.
Or even like, oh, here's the train trestle, should we go across it? No, we shouldn't. And then later, here's a really long train trestle, should we go across it? Right? Mm-hmm. And so it was just like setting up, like, here's gonna, well, I'm going to tell you later, this is going to happen. I'm going to tell you later, this is going to happen. I didn't cry when my brother died. I don't know why I have to go see the dead body so I can cry. I should have looked up how the actual novella ends, if it ends by saying, I actually wrote it down because he's typing it on his old green screen.
Oh, I laughed so hard at that typing. The typing looks like, it looks like an 80s, like a movie from the 80s where the computer is the villain and it like types by itself.
It really
That's
was.
That's really what it looked like.
Yeah.
Like an 80s movie about a villainous computer. Like it was green. Why was he typing in green on a black screen?
It's what it was.
I know. It just, it looks like an 80s villainous computer now.
I know.
Like,
the thing that I really missed is he didn't save it to his floppy disk.
Oh, I know. What was he thinking? He just left to take his kids to the pool.
He just left and I was like, it's going to crash. It is so going to crash.
Gordy, what were you
Put that
thinking?
On a floppy right now, Gordy.
But how can he re-come up with the lines that you're about to read?
I know. Here we go. I never had any friends later on in life like the ones I had when I was 12. Jesus, does anyone?
And then he stares at it and he goes, nailed it. And then he leaves.
Yep.
Yep. Nailed it.
Call in Rob Reiner right now.
That probably does come out of the Stephen King story, I'm thinking.
I'm thinking it may.
Yeah.
But.
Was this Stephen King's, like, cocaine heavy period of, of life? It might explain a little bit, maybe.
Maybe.
Yeah. Did you love the dream with, like, the light that was crazy and his dad literally telling him it should have been you? Did you love that? That was so subtle.
Yeah. We can go on and on.
Yep. All of the things.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Going to the store and the storekeeper saying, do you play football like your brother? Your mm-hmm. brother sure was good. Mm-hmm. Are you like your brother? You're a good brother?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sure. That's what people say to people who have lost their brother, you know? Oh, my God. You know, we can figure out. But it was one of my favorite parts of the movie was I forgot that John Cusack was in it.
Oh, oh, mid-80s John Cusack?
Yeah.
Oh.
He almost single
When I saw the picture of him, I was like, oh, my God, John Cusack is the older brother? And then he had a couple of scenes, and I was like, yes. Oh, there's nothing I love more than mid-80s John Cusack.
I know. He was almost going to be my Star by Far. But he didn't deliver Star by Far performance. Super happy to have him in the movie. But so anyway, so that was the hard part of it. But I'm going back to the nature part because then... You know, Gordy's keeping watch and he's sitting on the tracks and the deer shows up.
Uh-huh.
And then he says in the voiceover, I was waiting for a time to tell them, but I never did. I always just kept that deer to myself. What is that supposed to mean? Right?
I asked myself the same question when I was watching. I was like, you saw a deer? And like, what was the significance of looking in the deer's eyes?
And why did he keep, of all things, that to himself? And so I could only say that Stephen King and his hackneyed attempt to make...
Really, just go after him.
I mean, if they're going to come after me for Jim Carrey, I might as well earn it, right? You know, and his hackneyed attempt to make nature this revelatory force in these young boys' lives... He has this deer show up and they have this profound connection. And then there's no explanation. There's no lead up to it. Everything else is super heavy handed. And then we'll just throw a deer in there and he just looks at the deer. And then we go, this is the most profound moment of the movie. And then the deer leaves, right? Mm. And so we're then supposed to read all this stuff into it that I think he's just hoping we do so that it gives it a depth that it didn't have.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's what I'm going with the deer. It was a Hail Mary pass from Denny LaChance that gets some meaning in this movie.
From Denny LaChance.
Isn't that his brother, Denny?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I'm just going to throw
in. Oh, that the deer represents his dead brother?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, that's what it is?
That's what I was like, okay, is he supposed to now be communing with nature in a way that lets him access a spirituality that's beyond what he was able to access in his little small town?
Mm-hmm.
And the deer is kind of saying there's greater things in this world and your brother didn't die in vain. And, you know, and so he's seeing the wisdom of nature mm-hmm. and the, you know, is that what's happening in the scene?
Mm-hmm.
Right. Cause why else would he not tell them? You know,
it didn't make sense to me why he would keep that as a secret.
It was so profound to him. And the only thing that we have heard from him that's profound is, you know, his writing, which he shares with him,
mm-hmm.
his buddies, and his relationship with his brother.
Yeah.
Those are the two things that he values the most, you know, mm-hmm. his friendship with these guys, specifically Chris,
mm-hmm.
you know, he's not really,
they're, yeah.
The other guys are throwaways, but his friendship with Chris and his relationship with his brother,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then he thinks he's a writer. Right. But he's even at that point, he's like, I don't know if I'll ever write anything good or, you know.
Yeah.
He's still not sure. Right. So the relationship with the deer, I was like, it has to be like symbolic of his relationship with his brother.
Uh-huh.
And so that's why it's this Hail Mary, okay, Danny LaChance pass.
I see that. Yeah. Because it didn't make sense to me that he was keeping that as a secret from anybody at the time. You know, like.
His whole life.
He literally saw a deer.
He's only telling us.
Yeah.
The first people he's telling.
Okay.
Well, so then, like, if we're going to. Because I have things to say later.
Okay.
You know, so I don't know. You know, this was like. For me, there was like. This was a key scene.
Okay.
Because it just showed how heavy-handed so much of this was, which took away my nostalgia, killed a little bit of my nostalgic love of this movie.
Uh-huh.
So a little bit of my nostalgic love of this movie died in this viewing.
Okay.
So if I sound angry on this podcast, it is!
You know? Stephen King has murdered your nostalgia.
Well, no, it wasn't Stephen King, but, you know, it's my maybe as a 12-year-old, I would have loved this more. You know, and so yeah. I probably saw it when I was, you know, in my early 20s.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's actually what I wanted to ask you, because you're talking about how, like, all of these themes are so heavy-handed, and I think that that's totally true in the movie. I don't disagree with that. And so I've asked this question about other movies. So who is this movie for? Do you think this is a movie for 12-year-olds to watch? And that's why, you know, for a 12-year-old, that those things would seem revelatory then?
This is a great question, because I think you are correct.
So, like, as adults looking at it, it really is a movie that's bathed in nostalgia, right? That the fact that it's set in the time that it is, there's this, like, again, this idea of, like, oh, kids got to be kids, and they just got to go out into the woods and, like, mm-hmm. mess around and learn to be themselves, you know, all of this kind of, like, idealized nostalgic view of what childhood and early adolescence used to be, right? Mm-hmm. And they're so highly stylized, too. Like, mm-hmm. the greasers are, like, such stereotyped greasers. Chris has got his little pack of cigarettes in his shirt sleeve when he's 12 years old. You know, it's so highly stylized and nostalgia, so maybe like that could be an appeal to an adult, to adults, but I do think this is a movie maybe that is for teens and like younger people.
No,
that and that if you saw this as a teen, you'd be like, or as a young, you know, tween maybe, you would go, oh wow, like that is really, you know, you would be able to latch onto those themes,
right? And so separating Stephen King from Rob Reiner, you know. And so I would say it's why Rob Reiner called us, right? You know?
Yes.
Because that he actually does create this movie for young boys,
mm-hmm.
right? And so the movie is kind of made for that audience, not for me.
Mm-hmm.
And so as an adult, when I watch it,
I'm like, oh my God, I get it.
Yes, exactly. It's not very compelling to an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And so shout out, right,
mm-hmm.
to him. Like, I'm going to make a movie for these. And, you know, and so if we say, compared to the people who made the KB,
mm-hmm.
right, they did not make that movie for young people. They made that movie for creepy old dudes.
Yeah.
Right. And it wasn't a movie that spoke to young people. It spoke to, you know, nostalgic middle-aged women on mm-hmm. Netflix, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? And so my hope would be there's a bunch of, you know, 12-year-old boys watching this movie going, wow, the 50s would have been great. Can you mm-hmm. imagine if we could just take off for the weekend and not tell our parents and go find a body.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a great thing to do as a boy.
Yeah.
You know, just build a fire in the woods. You can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
No fires allowed.
Yeah. You know? Get covered in leeches.
And yeah, just take your dad's gun and go
play drown each other and all the things that boys run away from trains.
Yeah.
Sing songs.
Taunt the junkyard dog.
Yeah.
Just a great time for a boy. And the parents are just like, okay, I guess he's not here.
Yeah.
And so I can see how there would be a great appeal.
Mm-hmm. I think that the other thing, thinking about this being like a movie that like young boys would watch, there's also, you know, I think that those things would appeal to, I have never been a young boy, but I would think that those things would appeal, you know, that there is this like going out to the woods, being free, kind of things that came up in The Kings of Summer as well, going to see a body, right? That there's this illicit excitement to it, right? But there's also like a real, you know, I think this does kind of go back to Rob Reiner as well, that there's a real like genuine sweetness in this movie too, in the relationships that, especially between Chris and Gordy.
But Chris and Teddy.
Like, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. That I really enjoyed that. You know, they're ribbing each other, they're fighting each other, all of those things. But there is this like real genuine sweetness and like tenderness between them and like the way that they take care of each other, right? Stand by me, you know, again, laying it on thick. But yeah, that's one of the things that I really liked about this was how much they genuinely very much cared for each other.
Yeah.
And took care of each other.
Well, so I'm glad you're saying that because I wrote down my ranking beforehand because this is what you're saying is changing my mind a little bit because, you know, I mean, it is one of the beautiful things about the movie is you get to see like, Jason Manzoukas, you know, what are the rules of this movie?
Uh-huh.
Right. And so this movie really clearly shows you what are boy rules.
Uh-huh.
You know, so like every time Teddy makes Vern flinch, two for flinching.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Vern makes him flinch, he goes two for flinching. He's like, wait. And Vern's confused about the rules.
Uh-huh.
Those are boy rules, right? Or like when Chris saves Teddy from the train.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, Teddy's all mad. And he's like, skin it, man.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And he's like, no. And he's like, no, skin it, man. Mm-hmm. And so there's the rules.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have the rules of it.
Yeah.
Even if the rules to other people, like even for Vern, he's like, hey, the rules don't make sense. A lot of the rules don't make sense. Mm-hmm. Right?
And I was saying, you know, in my predictions about this movie that one of the things I thought about was like, you know, I thought that there was going to be boys walking down train tracks. And why I thought that is because I know it's something that Stranger Things, which is, you know, this era's kind of, you know, obviously built on all of these 80s movies.
Yeah.
And there, I think one of the things people like about Stranger Things too is that it has those same echoes of, you know, these young boys who have these rules around friendship and who also, there's this very genuine sweetness and this really like clear way that they prioritize taking care of each other.
Yeah.
Especially in the face of like adults who don't do the same thing for them. That they, that they really, that's like their highest priority is like honesty and like taking care of each other.
Yeah.
So it's like, I mean, if I was watching this as a young boy, I would assume that those things, you know, are so clearly laid out that they would come through to me as those are things that are important and valuable.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, aside from, you know, let's go see a body.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
All the little things, right? They flip the coins.
Mm-hmm.
That's a Gucci. That's a bad sign. It's a Gucci. And then they have an argument about what the Gucci is.
Yeah.
Oh, there's so many good scenes.
All right. What else?
And it is a direct parallel to Stranger Things.
Yeah. I mean, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's what Stranger Things is built on.
Is
nostalgia in the same way, right?
Right.
Now we have 2016 to 2018, you know, deep nostalgia about what being a kid in the 1980s was like.
Right. Yeah.
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 Yeah. And you have the same characters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't think of the curly headed guy, Gaetan
Matarazzo. Yeah.
He's Vern, right?
Yeah. I mean,
I brought the food.
I brought the comb. Yeah.
He I brought lost a flashlight.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
All the things he brings.
Oh, and, you know, Will is the Gordy. You know,
correct.
He's the observer. He's
absolutely.
The one that, and they all kind of are kind of protective about him because he's this, you know,
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a little difference because whatever 9 or whatever her name is.
Yeah, 11.
11, yeah, she shows up, right?
Yeah.
Which is a different dynamic than, but still, the 4 of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I guess, We don't want to spend time thinking through the exact parallels
right,
of this,
but it's very similar,
is
right?
Is Lucas the Teddy? He's not quite as crazy as Teddy is. They're not smoking in Stranger Things. Man, the number of cigarettes these kids smoke in this movie. Oh, man. Yeah. But it goes back to that same idea of, again, I wanted to shout out a little bit of, like, the trope watch. And a little bit of, you know, as well parallels to Kings of Summer, you know, which seems to be this theme that comes up in a lot of these movies of, especially in these boy movies, it seems like that these boys are living into certain ideas of masculinity that they are handed down to, that they get handed down to them by adults. And like in, you know, in Kings of Summer, they had certain ways that they were acting out masculinity by going to like kill things in the woods and build things together. And then in this, you know, they're smoking cigarettes and they're cursing and they're, you know, I'm trying to think, oh, and then there's this kind of, you know, they talk about, well, they talk a lot, you know, they have these, very fraught relationships with their fathers, most mm-hmm. of them, right? I think all of them except for Vern. Mm-hmm. Who knows what, we don't know anything about Vern's dad, but... No. You know, that they, again, you know, Chris is talking about how, you know, he wants to go somewhere where nobody knows who he is because he's burdened by his family and his reputation, as is Gordy, right? As is Teddy. They're all defined by who their fathers or their brothers are, like who the men in their family are. And they don't, but, you know, Chris gets out of that, you know, thinking back to what we were talking about when it comes to Kings of Summer, do you then become the kind of man that your father was, you know, it seems like Chris doesn't, right? He enrolls in the college courses. He becomes an attorney. Yeah. And he dies kind of a hero, which is what they said they wanted to be. Oh. Somebody does escape the vision of masculinity that their father sets. All right. So you have a realization that you came to about this movie.
Right. And it's going to lead right into what you're saying here, okay. That Chris escaped. You know, we had a drive-by shout-out the last time about disagreement about the Kings of Summer, right? Uh-huh. About the ending.
Yes.
And so there were some Debbies that we, living room Debbies, that disagreed about my interpretation of the ending, that your father's put you in this rut and it's very difficult to get out of. You know, he's going to be a single old curmudgeon like his dad, and the other guy is going to be a, you know, emasculated... ciabatta eating, you know, stay at home dad, right? So in this one, when you just said, you know, so Chris got away, he got out of it. Mm-hmm. And so at the end, when he's kind of given the rundown of what happened to everybody, you know, so Vern got married right out of high school and became a forklift operator and had four kids, mm-hmm. you know, because he doesn't see them after middle school, really. They mm-hmm. kind of go their separate ways. And Teddy tried to get into the army twice, but he couldn't because of his eyesight and his ear. And so he ended up in jail, is what he said.
Yeah.
And so, you know, very like, again, thank you for being so stereotypical, Stephen King, right? That
I wanted more for Teddy.
Yeah, you either go into the service or you go into jail. There's just not much difference between the two.
Yeah.
Yeah, way to lock it in, right? And so then we have our guy Gordy, who, you know, becomes, you know, is played by Richard Dreyfuss, Tree of Evil. Just saying, all you Jim Carrey people out there, Richard Dreyfuss is on the Tree of Evil. So I didn't even put Jim Carrey near it. But anyway, Richard Dreyfuss then is supposedly a good father because there he is with his boys and he goes out and snaps towels with them on the lawn mm-hmm. as they close, mm-hmm. right? So we're supposedly thinking he's not his father. But he only has one boy. The other one's a friend.
Yeah.
And so we're not really sure if he's a good father because he got the son he always wanted like his father did. Mm-hmm. And he didn't have to deal with the unwanted son. Mm-hmm. So not really clear. So that's not a clear thing for us in that movie. But then we have Chris, who's supposedly the breakaway, right? Mm-hmm. He breaks away from the path that he set. And he was like, you know, that was a big scene in the woods when he's crying. I don't, you know, the teacher stole from me because she could because that's uh-huh. who I am. And if I could go somewhere where they didn't know me, I could be something different, mm-hmm. right? And so this is the heavy-handedness of the movie that I'm going to just call out. But it did lead me to the realization that why are the parents always so bad in all these movies? Like, they're so mm-hmm. bad. It's not okay to just not be like a mediocre parent. You have to be a really kind of, you know, dead one, missing one, or completely inept one.
Yeah.
And so we only have a couple examples of like...
good parents?
Yeah.
Yeah. I was trying to think.
You know?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who is actually...
White Wine Dad.
White Wine Dad.
You know? Crawdad was doing his best.
Crawdad was not. Right? He was another joke of a parent, right?
Oh, uh-huh.
Grab that and hang so we don't have that. And, you know, so...
You just hung up on Rob Reiner.
Oh, no, Amber. Amber.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
She's calling back.
Calling back. Oh, no.
Calling back. All right. So it wasn't Amber Ruffin or Rob Reiner or even Joel Courtney.
Oh.
Okay.
Still waiting on that call.
I know. But we know the phone works now. All of you know it worked. So anyway, but, you know, so back to the heavy-handedness of it. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, so there's nature, the deer, and that's this big thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the train.
Mm-hmm.
And so we see the train several times, mm-hmm. right? Like Teddy is tempted with this jousting with the train.
Uh-huh.
And that's a big scene, you know, is the train going, come on, Teddy's going to kill you, it's going to kill you.
Uh-huh.
And then he gets saved by Chris, right?
Uh-huh.
And then they're coming across the trestle, right? And they're like, ah, you know. We're going to die uh-huh. as the train's coming into uh-huh. us, you know. And so here it's coming. And so here is the train coming at them. And I'm saying this is my realization that all of these really terrible parents and all these other movies that we've watched, you know, this movie is saying, Jesus, did you ever have any other friends than the friends you had when you're 12?
Uh-huh.
And as a father... the answer is yes.
Yes.
My best friends are not the friends I had when I was 12. I still have friends from when I was like 15.
Uh-huh.
And those are great friends to me and I love those friends. But then I have friends from when I had a different phase of my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so like, you know, I know people whose college friends are their best friends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then there's friends who when they first have children, the other people who have children at the same time, they become their best friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's other people that then start a career later in life. And the people that start their careers at the same time, those become their best friends. So I would say I have four periods of these are the best friends that I will ever have.
Mm-hmm.
And they happened at four different periods in my life, not just when I was 12.
Uh-huh.
You know, so like when I was like, you know, 15, when I was in my mid 20s, when I was in my mid 30s, and then when I was in my mid 40s.
Uh-huh.
Right? And now that I'm in my mid 70s.
Uh-huh.
You know.
You look great. You
I know.
You're
I feel great.
You're looking great for mid 70s.
Feeling great. Rob, come on.
I wouldn't say you were any older than 69.
Okay. Whoa, that's really quite flattering. 10 years younger. But, you know, and so there's this sense that, like, okay, parents are awful because adulthood is awful.
Yeah.
And so adulthood is the train. The train is adulthood. And that's what they're running from. That's what they're afraid of.
Mm.
That's what's coming to get them. You know? And you can't get off the track that is your father's trench that he's created for you.
Oh,
right?
No.
And you can run and you can avoid it.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally, your friend might pull you off.
Mm-hmm.
So your friend might pull you off and the train goes by and you're like, what were you doing? Don't you see who I'm going to become? That's what Teddy's saying because he tries to go into the army later.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think his dad was at Normandy. I think they never say it, but I was waiting for the revelation that his dad wasn't.
Yeah.
And he's just living a lie.
Uh-huh.
And then he can't get in the army. Guess what? His dad wasn't in the army.
Uh-huh.
That's what I'm thinking anyway. But, you know, so he can't get out of the way of that train that's coming.
Yeah.
Vern can't get out of the way of the train that's coming, right? And Gordy, you know?
Yeah.
I'm suspecting, I'm going to postulate or hypothesize or speculate that he loves his son because his son is the son that he would want.
Uh-huh.
And he's really grateful that he didn't have two because then he might have had, you know, Vern as another son, and he wouldn't have liked him, or Teddy, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
He didn't really like those guys.
No.
You know, and so anyway, so he can't avoid the train either. Even though he thinks he can't avoid the train, and he's really become his father, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, Then Chris, who we think has escaped,
uh-huh.
the train comes and gets him. He's in that family of ne'er-do-wells,
mm-hmm.
you know, who are going to end up dead or in jail
because mm-hmm.
they're thieves.
Dead.
They're thieves, right?
Yeah.
And so they're going to get killed in some underworld activity. And so even though he thinks he's gotten out of it because he's become a lawyer,
uh-huh.
he gets killed in a robbery, in a knife fight in a robbery.
A knife fight in like a fast food
joint, right? Yeah. Maybe yeah. it wasn't a robbery. I was thinking it was robbery,
no,
but
it was
I think
argument.
It was an argument.
You guys argued.
Yeah. And there's even that part, Stephen King's heavy-handedness, when Kiefer Sutherland uh-huh. pulls out the knife, Ace uh-huh. pulls out the knife, and so then he gets killed by a knife later in life. Because it's going to come and get you, uh-huh. he said it, and then it does, uh-huh. right? right? That's my realization, that every bad parent we see from now on is the trope of...
It's the train.
The train, and adulthood sucks, and it's coming to get you, and this is what it looks like.
Yeah, why do you think that there are so many movies about, like, that are romanticizing childhood as, like, the only time you're ever going to be happy?
That is a great question.
Are there just a bunch of people that were only happy when they were kids?
Oh, my God. And so we have to hold this thought, because when we get to Creep Week,
uh-huh.
It is kind of what I would say the gestalt of creepiness is.
Uh-huh.
If I can just... You know,
get back what I felt like.
Yeah, the picture of Dorian Gray, you know, if I can uh-huh. just usurp that youth from them.
Yeah.
Then it will bring me back to my youthfulness.
Yeah.
And so I'm not sure why that exists. And obviously there's things about adulthood that are really not super fun. You're not running down the tracks, punching each other, singing theme from Paladin, mm-hmm. right?
I have another question for you about this then, because I don't know the answer to this, but do you think that there are more movies, because we're going to have Creep Week, which is about all of these men trying to recapture this moment.
Correct.
Right? And I'm sure, and I can probably think, you know, if I thought about it a little more, maybe some examples of this, but do you think that there's a lot more of this kind of romanticization of like childhood and like young adolescence by men than there is? You know, is this something that comes up for men more? Or do you think it's more also maybe that, you know, there are so many more stories that have like films and TV made by men that this story gets told more? Do you think that men romanticize this period more?
Okay, so I'm gonna put up the shields here. Because the Debbies are not going to be happy with this answer I'm gathering. But I'm just going to speculate. And so I say this in the hope of this can be a dialogue, not like this is what I think is true.
Uh-huh.
You know, because even if we're saying this about men, there's going to be a lot of men that say, wait, no, mm-hmm. you mm-hmm. know, that's not blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And I get it, right? We're on a continuum. And so we're just looking at specific archetypal
yeah.
pictures, right?
Yeah.
And so I get that there is a bazillion ways to be a man and a bazillion ways mm-hmm. to be a woman mm-hmm. and a bazillion ways to be neither.
Uh-huh.
Right? So just
yes.
so we're clear about that before I go any further,
mm-hmm.
you know, I get all of that. And I still think that there are archetypal gestures in this world,
mm-hmm.
right? And we have, to varying degrees, more of them or less of them. And now it's what gives us the multiplicity of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
So that being said, you know, so you say, like, if we look at the Creep Week, it's all these men trying to reclaim their youth by seducing youth,
uh-huh.
right? Which I would say is a masculine gesture.
Uh-huh.
That kind of hypersexuality is a masculine gesture, right? And then if we look at, I'm going to look at the contra to see how does it play out in females? Because you're saying, do women have this kind of same nostalgic look back on their
mm-hmm.
youth.
Mm-hmm.
And if we look at the coming of age movies that we watch that have like females as the lead,
mm-hmm.
a lot of the theme of those movies isn't going out into nature,
mm-hmm.
but rather, am I desirable as a person?
Mm-hmm.
And really, am I desirable as an object of affection?
Mm-hmm.
Is a lot of what the movies are. And so I go, if we look at what the middle-aged women's movies are,
mm-hmm.
they tend to be those times, right? What is it, the Tuscan Sun?
Yeah.
She moves to Italy and now these hot Italian guys are after her again.
Uh-huh.
Oh, once again, I'm desirable.
Uh-huh.
which is the same kind of creepiness. And I'll just like, just to keep everything flowing in, you know, I watched Carpool Karaoke with Barbara Streisand. It was unwatchable because of the plastic surgery, right? She looks like a cat. And I was like, it has to be that she did that to keep her attractiveness. It was like, I'm going to try to remain physically attractive. And it's just, it's just hard to look at because when I see that, that's what I see. Someone so desperate to hold on to their youth, which is a creepiness. That's the same kind of creepiness of men seducing young women to hang on to their youth. And when you see that, you go, oh, that's just kind of creepy.
Ooh, that's so weird because there's so many parallels to this idea that, like, I don't know, of, like, other things, you know, but that, like, that there's so much about, like, women are controlling of their themselves in trying to recapture youth, that they're trying to make themselves more attractive, that there's, like, this inward focus to it, and that the men are projecting it onto other people. Like, that, and that is often the same thing if, like, women hurt themselves. If they're upset, women hurt themselves, and men hurt others. Oh, that's really creepy parallels you just gave between me goosebumps. Those things. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that was like a major really...
Oh.
We might have a not-nonsense section, right?
Oh, really?
This is not-nonsense. This is, like, pretty deep, right?
Yeah.
And so that was my realization in the movie, and then your question.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does kind of play out that way.
It really does, doesn't it?
Yes.
Oh, wow. And either way, yeah... It's this, yeah. It's just different expressions of that same thing.
Yes. We need to take a deep breath here.
We really do, man.
Okay, let's go to our favorite line.
Let's come back around to some more nonsense about this.
Okay, so I think I get to say favorite line first, which I'm super happy about. All right,
you're going to take the best line of the movie.
Because I think, and I have some other ones.
Okay.
You know? Okay.
What is your best line of the movie?
My best line of the movie comes from my star by far as well.
Okay.
Which is Vern. Oh. Vern always my star by far.
Oh, Vern. I did not recognize Jerry O'Connell.
I know. I had to think about him this morning. I was like, oh, didn't he marry Rebecca Romijn's? And I was like, no, that's John Stamos.
Yes.
And so I was confused.
Jerry O'Connell's married to somebody else, though.
But he's the Cush in Jerry Maguire.
I mean, I don't know. I can only think of Jerry O'Connell as the guy who now hosts, like, a Bravo show. Jerry O'Connell, he tries really hard. That's what I would say. I would just say, Jerry O'Connell, he's doing his best out there.
But I'm just going to have to
just say... Just like Vern, he's doing his best.
One of the things that was, like I was like, it was kind of unwatchable, that I didn't think River Phoenix was a very good actor in this.
Mm-mm.
You know? And so I appreciate that he was actually the right age.
Yeah.
And, like, Will Wheaton, I was like, I didn't think he was very good. And Teddy, Corey Feldman, I think
he was pretty good.
A little overacting, you know, but he was like getting after
it. But he had to, you know, it was part of his personality.
Part of his personality, but he was a little over. So I was okay, so he went a little over. But Verno nailed it.
I thought he was great.
He was great.
Jerry O'Connell was great.
Crushed it.
Because I was really analyzing the child actors the whole time, you know? And we'll come around to this with our new segment, what I was watching before, because there are some child actors in what I was watching before.
Okay.
And so it's interesting to see who's better and who's worse. And but I was watching Jerry O'Connell, and I had the subtitles on, because sometimes I like to watch the subtitles. And I was like, wow, looking at, there's a shout-out to, like, a very good Instagram that's about... you can watch the scene happen and you can look at the script. It'll scroll through the script as the scene happens.
Nice.
And you can really see how people take the lines. It's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
So I was kind of doing that with the subtitles and watching Jerry O'Connell. Jerry O'Connell, he nailed it.
Yes.
Little baby face, Vern. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Star by
far. So he was your star by far.
Absolutely. And so he doesn't have the best line, but the best line is delivered to him.
I think I know what you're going to say.
Yeah.
Good.
They wake up the next morning, and he was like, what'd you buy for breakfast? Couldn't you buy something else for breakfast? Something good, like Pez and Coke? And he names, like, three things I can't remember.
Uh-huh.
And then Gordy delivers the best line. I guess a more experienced shopper could have gotten more for your 7 cents. So that is my favorite line.
That was also when I did not write down a lot of actual lines in this movie. Unlike The Kings of Summer, which was full of jokes, there were not a lot of really fun lines in this movie. I did not write a lot of specific ones. Yeah. So that was also, I have to say, my favorite line of the movie.
Okay, well, then I'll pitch the second one because you didn't have two.
Okay.
Okay. At one point, Vern and Teddy, this is why Vern is the star by far. At one point, Vern and Teddy are walking and he's like, you think Mighty Man beats up Superman? He's like, no way, Superman beats up. He's like, no, I saw Mighty Mouse carrying 8 elephants the other day. And then I think Teddy says, no way a cartoon beats up a real person.
They really are concerned with, like, the real questions of life in here. Yeah, yeah. When they're like, what is, you know, so Mickey's a mouse, and Donald's a duck, and Pluto's a dog. What is Goofy? Very serious questions.
And I have to say, I mean, one of the great things about it when we're talking about is it real boyness. Tell us a story, Gordy. And so he talks about Lardass.
Yeah, like, the whole
that pie. And that is a boy. That's a great boy just story.
Blueberry vomit on everybody.
And chain vomiting.
Yeah, just group vomiting. Yeah.
The paternal order of antlers got barfed on by the sisterhood.
Yeah. I think I'm going to shout out my favorite outfit of the movie, which was Kiefer Sutherland in his little greaser outfit with his, like, patterned shirt.
Yeah.
That was a great look. I would wear that one. That was a great look. I would wear that Kiefer Sutherland look. No cred to Kiefer Sutherland himself, but...
Okay, but the blonde guy that you shouted out earlier, I can't remember his name. We should look at his name. But I was like... It's so awesome that they went into the West Side Story.
They just plucked him right out.
What's the
Baby
girl
John
that,
or whatever.
Yeah, Baby John, the girl that wants to be part of the game.
Yeah, what was her name?
They plucked out Baby John's outfit and put it on him. And I was like, oh, Baby John's outfit.
It's really true. Yeah. That guy then moved to New York City and joined an all-white gang. Yep. I think that's the sequel to Stand By Me. That blonde guy moved to New York.
That was my favorite outfit of the movie. they recycled Baby John's outfit.
Yes.
So back to some nonsense after that series.
Yes. Woof, man. Yes. So,
okay,
so I'd like to shout out, I also agree. I did not think River Phoenix was that great. And I think kind of going back to that nostalgia though, when you watch River Phoenix, knowing, you know, that he is already this tragic figure to everybody who knows what happens to River Phoenix, that even watching him as is kind of like too wise for his years, like almost like too like fragile for this world, kind of pretend tough guy with the super like, you know, who has this super tender heart. Like, he's just too tender and fragile for this world. It kind of, like, lends him this aura that I don't think he would have if you watched the movie in the 80s. So it is kind of, it is, you know, when he blinks out of existence at the end of the movie, you know, it is pretty kind of touching based not on his performance, but on him as a person. It is.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I think I have to say, we really don't have, like, a real criteria for who the star by far is. When I saw that John Cusack was in this movie, mid-80s John Cusack is my favorite of all time. I will never not love a long-faced, earnest baby John Cusack. Yes. Come at me, people who don't, like, say anything. That era John Cusack is the best. God, it's like Lloyd Dobler, but in the 50s, man. Just him is, like, and obviously he's this angelic figure, you know, that can do no wrong in the movie because it's, you know, see, again, he has to be perfect as the opposite of Kiefer Sutherland in this movie. So, blonde baby John. he's a star by far with his like 4 lines. And then, just angelic, you know, early 20s John Cusack is,
Okay.
Never get over it. Okay. He is, will forever be. Talk about like being influenced when you're a teen. Will forever be the romantic ideal. Yeah. Say anything, you're a John Cusack. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. All right.
And then I'm just going to real quickly.
I did write my last note as hilarious computer typing was my last note about that. It really is.
Before we rate the movie, or maybe we'll do it as we have preview what's coming up.
Oh, so now, yes, because we got to get back around.
Yep.
So, again, as always, our episode is sponsored by... Sustaina Butter.
Sustaina Butter.
Ah, we love you, Sustaina Butter. You make delicious. If I was going to wander through the woods looking for a body,
yeah,
I would take Sustaina Butter.
If I was going to spend 7 cents on anything to sustain me, it would be Sustaina Butter.
Yes. If I had some young tween sons who wanted to go off into the woods and start a new life in the woods, I would just pack them a backpack full of Sustaina Butter, and then I would trust that they were going to be okay.
Classic kidnapping. They took our children and all
and all the Sustaina Butter. Yes. So thank you, Sustaina Butter, for continuing to be our actual sponsor of this show.
Actual sponsor.
We really appreciate it.
And we actually like your product,
too. We really do. So we like Tony's. You just don't love that one flavor.
I'm not going to eat that flavor again, but I do love the milk chocolate, and I do love the chocolate, the caramel sea salt. I'm going to try some more Tony's now that they have them on display, like all of them, at Natural Foods Grocers. Sponsor us. Zephyr.
Yes, come on,
Zephyr.
We know
you're listening.
So we'd like to also introduce a new segment before we rate the movie.
Some music.
Our new segment is called What I Watched Before This.
Uh-huh, and this all stems out of Step It Up.
It is Step It Up. Yeah.
Step It Up.
Step Up should be on our list. I think it is a coming-of-age movie. Oh, it'd be beautiful. People learn to love through the power of dance.
Step It Up. The mashup between Set
actually,
It Up.
And that actually would be a mashup of a movie that I saw as I was coming of age. Uh-huh. Yeah. Ugh. It's a great one. So the new segment is called What I Watched Before, which is based on our watching of Set It Up, because before watching Set It Up, I watched The KB.
Yep.
So it made Set It Up seem like an incredible film.
Yep.
And you watched Nanette.
Yep.
Which made Set It Up seem like a terrible film.
Yes, it was, a slap in the face.
Mm-hmm. So, what were you watching before you watched this movie?
Yeah, so oddly enough, I was watching CNN's The 80s before watching this 1980s movie.
Okay.
And so I specifically had watched the episode on Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was what I was watching before I watched
this. How do you think it influenced your watching of this film?
I know, and that's a great question. And so I hadn't thought about it until you just now said it. And one of the things is that I had a certain perception of the Reagan years, having lived through them and not done so pleasantly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had a hyper vilification of Reagan, especially with the hyper worshiping of Reagan that has evolved recently.
Mm-hmm.
And so almost in a reaction to how worshipped he has become recently, I was like, wait, does nobody remember release of Iranian funds in America if they held the hostages until the election? So talk about meddling in elections, right? But he actually did some other things.
Mm-hmm.
So he actually appointed justices that were good jurists, which was, wow, what a novelty that is, right? And so it took a little bit of my hyper-nostalgic and ideological view of the Reagan years out of play, that I could maybe try to look at them a little more objectively.
Mm-hmm.
And then going into this, I had a very nostalgic remembrance of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it primed me to let go of some of the nostalgia, my own.
Interesting. I think I kind of had the opposite experience, because before watching this, I was watching, again, Netflix sponsor us, because I was watching the new Netflix original series, The Haunting of Hill House, which is based on a Shirley Jackson horror novel called The Haunting of Hill House, and it is shares a lot of themes with this, in that it takes place in the present and the past. And they're kind of, as adults, revisiting something that happened in their childhood, which was that they lived in this house that was incredibly haunted. And then, of course, it kind of turns psychological to how these parents then visited this trauma upon these children, or how these children's trauma as children, this trauma that they experience as children affects them as adults. And, you know, as processed through, like, horror, right? That they're literally being visited by ghosts that, you know, are parts of that trauma. So, also a lot of child actors in the flashbacks take place in the 80s. And so there's kind of some parallels in that. But obviously then, you know, it's something that it is very scary. There's a lot of jump scares and like terrifyingness to it. So I think I was primed to actually like enjoy this, more because I was like, well, at least, you know, there aren't going to be any ghosts hovering 3 feet above the ground, like that then she'll turn, that terrify a child so much it becomes a lifelong heroin addict. So, spoilers for The Haunting of Hill House. You learn that in like the first episode. It's not a spoiler. Yeah. So I think that the themes of that is even like a harsher set of ideas around the things that you traumatize you as a child will affect you so much that, you know, it leads to these really horrifying things in adulthood and kind of broken people. And so I think that this was actually then kind of a relief from that.
Okay.
So I think it made me like it more, to be honest.
All right, so I'm up first, and I've written this down
okay. Before
a discussion.
I know, because we're always affected by the discussion. Okay.
And so, I came into this movie thinking I was going to like it a lot more than I did.
Okay.
Because I had such warm memories for it. And so I'm giving this 6,471 kbs. Yeah.
6,000.
6,400.
Is that one of the lowest ratings we've given that either of us has given a movie since?
I think it's not as low as Set It Up.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. We did rate Set It Up lower.
And I think it's about the Edge of 17 for me.
Okay. That you like this about as much as you liked The Edge of 17.
Yeah, I think The Edge of 17, I was in 7,000 range.
What did I can't remember what I gave. I forget my ratings immediately.
Well, I had I closed it, but I think
I remember Dude as well.
Yeah, Edge of 17, you gave 15,000 kbs.
Okay. I know. I feel like I really need to sit down and think about my rating system a little bit more. Because I think
that's not the point. That would be no nonsense.
It would be nonsense. But I think that I'm getting confused in all of my numbers.
Okay.
Yeah. I actually think that this is about on par for me with The Kings of Summer. Because we're always looking for movies that we disagree on. Mm-hmm. I never seen this before, and I actually liked it quite a bit. I guess because it also has so many of the same themes as The King of Summer. And so I actually gave this a much higher rating, not entirely based on the 5 seconds of baby John Kim, of young John Cusack. So I actually gave this about the same what I did The Kings of Summer. So I gave this 23,899 kissing booths.
Oh.
KBs.
Yeah, KBs, yeah.
Yeah.
So we did not shout out a podcast, so we have to make sure it was, unless you can just shout one out real quick.
A podcast to shout out real quick right now?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Okay, so I'm going to shout one out real quick. I'm shouting out.
You're contributing to the podcast multiverse?
I am, because I'm shouting out. More perfect.
Oh, yeah.
In light of decisions that were made in the Supreme Court in the 70s and 80s that are affecting us, and how do we like then go back and revisit those and not be nostalgic about them, but say, how did this come to be?
Mm-hmm.
They are looking at these Supreme Court cases and the Supreme Court justices that have decided these cases. And it's a great podcast to kind of take the nostalgia or the ideological entrenchment off of this and to really try to look at how we get to where we get. And so I'm loving More Perfect. So shout out to More Perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then just coming before we move on to what we're watching next, I think when we told people we were going to watch Stand By Me, a lot of people say, are you going to talk about the homosexual undercurrents of it?
Oh.
And that's an old man's word, I realize,
mm-hmm.
to say homosexual, but so
homoerotic elements to it.
Yeah, perhaps. And we didn't talk about the leech scene, which is probably the one that when he looks in his pants and he sees a leech on his junk, he goes, Chris!
Uh-huh.
And then he pulls out a bloody hand from his, and then he faints.
Uh-huh.
A weird Stephen King scene.
Yeah.
And so anyway, we're not talking about that, but maybe we'll touch on a little bit when we get into our, what do we call that trilogy?
I thought we were calling that the gay love trilogy.
Is it?
Yeah.
I couldn't remember.
It's all gay love stories and gay coming of age stories.
I can't remember anything.
Yeah. Right. So we're watching Moonlight, Love, Simon, and I think Call Me By Your Name is our third one.
Okay. So when we get to that, maybe we'll bring this one back around.
Mm-hmm.
and say, look, here's the difference. Mm-hmm. You know, just because there's boys out there together, you can't just read into it automatically, mm-hmm. as opposed to Top Gun. Anyway, so what are we watching next?
Next, we are closing out our boy movie trilogy with Breaking Away.
Breaking Away.
I think we talked about it last time, but yes. So join us in 2 weeks.
Yep.
I have never seen Breaking Away, so we're gonna come back to what
Jezebel
says,
about? What?
Yeah, so.
What?
So we'll come back around to that.
Or as Amber said this week, what?
We do not sing Dixie on this podcast. No! We will come back in 2 weeks to talk about Breaking Away.
Thanks for talking nonsense.